Wonderful. It sounds like our testifiers or commissioners arrives. We'll go ahead and start the meeting. April 7th, 2026. I'll call the meeting to order. We do have a quorum established. Representative Hussein, have you had a chance to review the minutes?
Mr. Chair, I have read the minutes.
Would you please? Representative Hussein approves the minutes. All in favor, say
aye.
Opposed? Welcome back. With that, we'll actually, we've got a presentation today by Minnesota Housing Budgetary Process Overview. With that, we'll wait for our testifier. Thank you. Then we will follow that up with an informational hearing on Senate File 2434 today. But first, we'll approve the minutes. Thank you. We were told the commissioner was here. How's that? Welcome, Commissioner. We will start with your presentation.
Okay. Members of the committee, Chair Dotseth, members of the committee, my name is Jennifer Ho. I'm the Commissioner of Minnesota Housing. You guys transported from upstairs. I don't know how you did that fast. I'm here with Dan Kitzberger, my legislative director. Brian Baumtrog, my new deputy commissioner, will be joining in just a moment, as well as Lael and Amanda will be here momentarily as well, our whole team. Thank you for the opportunity to just kind of go under the hood a little bit, if you will, in terms of how agency budgets, program implementations, grants administration, and those things occur. It's not the most thrilling deck, but I think it's critical to understanding for the conversations that you're having right now. I'm going to start by talking about sources and uses of funds. It's something that we've talked about briefly before, so I will just briefly review that. If you take a look at the totality of Minnesota Housing's budget, we really have four sources of agency funds. We administer federal grants. Separate from what this legislature does, we have bonding authority. So we have proceeds from agency bond issuances. We make loans, and therefore we get repaid on those loans, so that's another source of revenue. And then all the work that we do together, state appropriated money, housing infrastructure, and geo bond proceeds. So those are the four sources of funds that we have. In terms of the top uses of those funds, our largest activity by far is homeownership lending, single family mortgages to help people buy homes. Our second largest program is the administration of the federal HUD rental assistance, project-based Section 8 that we do on behalf of HUD under contract. And then the third largest use is capital for housing construction and preservation. If you take a look at it with a picture, you'll see that in federal fiscal year, we operate on all three calendars, but in federal fiscal year 2025, we had about $1.8 billion in expenditures, which helped about 73,000 households. And again, as I said, our home buyer and home refinancing stuff is by far the largest, over $1 billion in 2025. And then again, the Federal Rental Assistance Contract Administration and the rental production. The rental production is kind of a mix of various sources of funds, including funds that you give us. You'll see down the line, they get smaller. Other just captures things like disaster recovery, a small housing mediation grant program, things like that. So just to give you a sense of the scale of these different programs. In terms of the uses, everything that we do via partnerships. So we work through lenders, we work through developers, we work through service providers, various community organizations, as well as tribes and local governments. And it is through those partners that we deliver what we do to Minnesotans. I think I'm not going to go into a lot more detail on this, but happy to come back if people have questions. So the way that we provide funding through these partners is predominantly loans, grants, or assistance programs. So that's a good way to think about the different kind of ways in which the money flows. So if you think about how the resources reach communities, we're either doing lending through mortgages and down payment assistance, or for many programs, we have a competitive request for proposals. That includes longstanding programs that the agency has had, as well as many of the new programs that were created in 23 and 24. And then you have also instructed us specifically with legislatively named grantees. And some of those flow through existing programs. So they're kind of a set use that from this program funds should go to this entity, or you did them for new specific uses that weren't covered by previous types of programs. Some of the resources are also formula-based in addition to the ways in which they can be competitive. So as we think about a program from conception to selection of grantees, contracting, and the life of the grant, you know, we're really focused on program integrity and compliance. How do we make sure that the programs are structured so that they do the purposes intended for the people intended in the way that they're intended? So that's a big part of this, and I'll just say this is a cool new construction project that my construction team got to go visit. It's a new 48-unit passive house construction in Rockford from our 2023 selections. So as a state agency, as kind of overseen by the Office of Administration, there are a whole bunch of grants management requirements that flow from statute and you to policies made over at admin in the Office of Grants Management. I just gave out a sampling of some of these provisions because they actually make up oftentimes the set of steps that we are required to follow as we set up programs, review proposals, consider awards, make awards, and so forth, and then just have the specific source of those available in case you wanted to do more digging of those. I think probably the other thing, you know, just to know is that we're kind of applying a set of standards as well as kind of a set of credit risk and risk management tools as we're working through these various processes. And to do so well, not only takes time, it's not just write a check, but it also requires staff to do those functions and therefore costs money in order to administer. So when we think about like the life cycle of a grant, we really think of it as three stages: pre-award, active award, and post-award, because there's things that we are busy doing in all of those. Sometimes if it's a brand new program, we actually have to translate what you put in statute into something that helps define how the program would actually work. We have to work through the criteria for grant applications and publish an RFP, accept applications and score them, have a process for reviewing and selecting. There's a whole pre-award risk assessment that we do before selection. And then there's the encumbrance of grant funds. And then with selected organizations, we need to negotiate and execute the exact terms of the contracts. While an award is active, and this can be anywhere from, you know, a year to as many as 5 years, there's a whole bunch of checks that happen between us and the grantee. So the grantee is performing the fund functions that they were given the money for. And then there are a bunch of rules around how funds are distributed and how we keep an eye on not only the budget, but the monitoring of activities. There's financial reconciliations that might occur over the life of the grant. There might be changes that are made, amendments to contract if needed, progress reports and final reports. And also this is where we try to bring technical assistance to bear if somebody is trying to figure out how to just navigate what's required in order to be able to use state or federal funds. And then when all the money is spent or the period of the grant has expired, there's a bunch of post-award activities that we need to do. And a lot of that is around, you know, data collection, what got done. But some of it is around understanding how well did the grantee do in accomplishing that task. And then there's just financial closeout stuff, the stuff of auditors. How much was given, how much was spent, was it all spent on eligible activities? And then through the whole life cycle of grants, there's a bunch of other things that are brought to bear around understanding where there might be potential conflicts of interest and how do you manage those conflicts of interest, making sure that we understand what the data reporting and record keeping requirements are going to be. And then also, what happens if there are concerns around misuse of funds, fraud, waste, or abuse? Do we have good mechanisms in place so people are aware of their avenues? So between the time that you decide to give us money and our ability to manage through the life cycle of the grant, this is a slide from the Office of Grants Management over at Admin, but a whole bunch of different people in my agency can have their hands, their eyes involved in that process from top to bottom. And then that also allows for some segregation of duties so that you don't have just one staff person making decisions about dispersing funds to and closing out grants. So we wanted to just give an example of how we manage program integrity. So this is from the Family Homeless Prevention and Assistance Program. It's been a longstanding core program of the agencies. And what you'll see is from the RFP process, selections, due diligence and contracting, grant monitoring and evaluation, and ongoing support, there are various checks at each stage of the grant life cycle and contracting process that allows us to to check to make sure that what we were contracting for is being done and that funds are being spent in an appropriate way. The other piece that we were asked to do kind of a slightly deeper dive on is the RFP process and initial funding selections. As I said earlier, most appropriated funding is awarded through a competitive request for proposal. The agency does the largest amount of funding through some consolidated RFPs, where we take multiple types of money that can be used for similar purposes in multifamily construction or preservation, or in single family acquisition, rehab, work, or new construction. And we have it set up so that you can come and apply for any of a mix of funds that are available, state and federal, but through a single RFP. The benefit to the developer in this is that you don't have to submit seven RFPs to try to put together the package of funding for a large apartment building, for example, because oftentimes the capital stacks on these programs are big, or that you come in and don't quite score high enough for limited funds, so you're writing a lot of proposals for things where you get a no. So by putting it all into a consolidated RFP, we're actually able to fully leverage the funds that are available in any given year and match what the developer wants to do with the types of funds where those are eligible activities, and it fits in terms of just what the funds can be used for. This annual process, which actually I think launches tomorrow, I think applications launched tomorrow for the single family and multifamily RFP, also allows us to match your timeline. So on May 18th, when you know how much money and what flavors of money you might give us, we already have a process underway that will collect proposals in July so that we can make funding decisions by December. So we will have attached your 2026 decisions to 2026 selections within the same calendar year. Now, because these are new construction projects, they won't get built in 2026. It takes time for them to be built. But the consolidated RFP and the timing of the annual process is a great efficiency tool, and I can brag on it because it was there long before I had this job. And it's one that our partners very much appreciate. For programs that we've had for a long time, we're constantly reevaluating the program guides to see if there have been statutory changes, to see if there are things that we've learned from grantee experience. And so periodically, our program guides, which are the translation of statute into how does this work, are updated. You might remember I have an independent board of directors. Those program guides are approved by the board. Similarly, we need a scoring system for each RFP, and if it's a program that we've operated over many years, we're constantly evaluating the effectiveness of the scoring mechanism. And then there's other things that we're always looking at, including the geographic balance, statewideness. And there are places where, for example, you might have a tribal or an Indian set-aside. The legislatively named grantees, it really depends on whether it was from within an existing program, where then we need to make sure that the existing program guide accomplishes what it was you specifically wanted to do. If it's a one-time purpose for a legislatively named grantee, and that purpose is clear, we don't usually need to do a program guide as long as the recipient of the funds understands that their job is to conform to statute and then the contract and the work plan they have with us that shows how they're going to do statutorily specified activities there. So this is just to give you a sample of what the selection process of an RFP looks like. So when we develop an RFP, that includes the scoring methodology and the timelines. It's published. We pull together a team of staff and community members that will be scoring the applications. They are all required to do conflict of interest disclosures, and the folks that are going to review the applications get trained on that process. So then when we get applications in, they're read and scored. And then we look at how things stack up in the scoring, what's been requested for funding, you know, where can we go? But then we also do a step back and say, do we have good geographic distribution in terms of who the selections would be, who the grantees would be if we did it on score? Sometimes there's parts of the state where we just didn't get an application. And so we have to kind of understand that we can't get complete, you know, regional geographic spread if we don't get an application. But we're also always looking at that back over time. Over the last 3-4 cycles of this funding program, if there are parts of the state where we're neither making awards or getting applications, we're going to do community-based work in between funding cycles to try to make sure that organizations that would have been eligible for those funds have better information about how to mount a successful application for those funds. When we have decided that this is the universe of folks that we believe we want to recommend to the board of directors to select, one of the newer steps is this pre-award risk assessment and financial assessment that I think was statutorily driven in the Department of Admin's Office of Grants Management processes. So it's a new step for us where we have to take a look at whether we believe that there are no concerns and we're going to pass them just as is, whether there's any special considerations that we need to have as we're looking at a prospective grantee, or whether there are actually concerns that make us think that we actually need to pull this potential grantee out of the pool. After the 2023 legislative session, because there were so many new programs and so many legislatively named grantees, internally we created a new Minnesota Housing Grants and Programs Committee. So we have an every other week standing meeting so that any part of my agency that is working on moving a new program or an old program through this process would know that they had a timely way to stop and get leadership approval to keep moving forward. We didn't want to have 30 different new things all having to find their way through the agency. And that's been a great tool for us to be able to do the necessary checks around pre-award risk assessment, selection, geographic distribution, and process before we advance something to a monthly board meeting. So that's something that I think we're really pleased that we had the foresight to put in place soon after the 2023 session. Our board meetings are public meetings. We post board packets a week in advance of the meetings. Staff present the proposed recommendations for grantee selection to the board of directors for approval. And then assuming that the board approves, you have the notification of grantees of the preliminary selections. The process is slightly different when you create a legislatively named grantee. So the biggest difference is that there's no RFP, and we're not involved in choosing which entity should get the money, but all the other grants management and compliance policies apply. So just because it's a legislatively named grantee doesn't shortcut all those other steps that we talked through, including pre-award risk assessment, you know, having a contract, and all the other pieces in place. I think that just the last piece I want to talk about is how we fund agency operations. I kind of going back to the original sources of funds slides, the easiest way to think of us is that we're kind of a federally authorized state-created bank that does a kind of banking activity around mortgage financing and home improvement loans and things like that. And we do bond issuances and a lot of like I say, banky things to make that happen. And all of the bank's operations are self-funded by the bank's own business model. So the legislature does not fund the operation of the banking side of what we do. And that's what, if you go back to the bar chart earlier in the slides, that $1 billion of single family production that we're doing, that is happening on the banking side of the agency. And then historically, because the size of the appropriations that the agency received, which were great, and a lot of state housing finance agencies don't get any appropriations from their state, all they are is the bank. But historically, when you have given us appropriated dollars and programs, you haven't had to create a separate administrative cost operating fund out of appropriations to pay for the programs that you give us. So we have been able to, and we've been able to use the interest earnings on those programs, and then because of their size, we've been able to use earnings from the bank to pay for the rest of the administrative costs of those programs. I think, you know, what's important to really understand about prior to 2023 is that we could do that largely without ever having to talk with you about it. It's something that that just happened because the size of the bank was big enough and the size of the appropriations and the admin costs was small enough that we could make that work. So between 2014 and 2023, the bank subsidized the administrative cost of the state appropriated programs in total to a tune of over $50 million. And this allowed 100% of your appropriated dollars to go directly into the program that they were funding. And then 2023 happened. Between the 2022 session and the 2023 session, the administrative work that we were asked to do something like tripled. Although I think if you took a look at the number of grant contracts administered, the number would be even higher than that. So in 2023, we began using statutory authority to retain a portion of appropriations for administrative expenses. Over the next few years, I think in ways that we could not have predicted, because I think the forecast on interest rates was very different at the end of the 2023 legislative session than it is today. But interest earnings and fees, you know, could cover all of the admin we had to build in order to do this. And in fact, because interest rates have stayed high, and because the disbursement process for such a large appropriation is slow because we don't write the check all at once, we have checks and balances for program integrity, and a lot of what we do is around construction, which just takes time to build. We've had a projection now of interest earnings that may actually be greater than the costs of those programs, but by law, the interest earnings on an appropriation, if they are greater than what's needed for admin, are added back to the initial program's uses. And then there were also programs set up where there was no mechanism for us to do that because we were asked to administer programs where we didn't actually touch the funds. Most notably, the State Housing Tax Credit and Contribution Fund, which has been wildly popular, and the local and affordable housing and statewide affordable housing aid, where we don't do competitions for dispersing the funds, but we have required duties to oversee how that funding works. So I think the thing that that I would hope you would take away from this is that the timing of the 2023 appropriations and the size of the appropriations also hit at a time where interest rates had come back up, and it's very hard to predict over what period of time they will remain. Over the life of the programs that you gave us funding for, the amount of cash that the agency has will decrease over time, but our administrative responsibilities to oversee and close out these programs has a long life cycle. You know, potentially, 7 years after we make an initial grant award, for example. So what we're really trying to understand is how do these interest earnings, which we have not had to talk about before because they just weren't a thing, how will they cover the agency's administrative expense over the life cycle of these grants so that we don't have to change the fundamental relationship that we've had with you, where you could appropriate money to us for programs without having to do an agency operational appropriation to cover the admin expenses of those. If the 2023 appropriations had been put into our base, I think this would be a very different conversation. But the vast majority of the 2023 appropriations will have a life cycle and then close out, and I will need to have staffing across all of our functions to make sure that we can oversee and close out those grants with integrity. So I hope that that approximates what it was that you were hoping that I would present today. Chair Igoe, happy to see you and happy to take any questions.
Well, thank you, Commissioner, for the presentation. Sorry for being a little late today. And again, was kind of getting caught up on everything you talked about before I got here. But I'll let other members get into discussion before I start asking you my questions. So who's first on my list today? Vice Chair Dotseth.
Thank you, Commissioner Holt. Question I've got, coming through pretty nonprofit, rental administrator you currently work with right now.
Commissioner Holt.
Chair Representative Dotseth, I don't have that answer. This is Deputy Commissioner Ryan Baumtrog, recently promoted, please tease him. The question was how many grantees do we have for our rental assistance programs?
Yep.
Are we talking about a specific rental assistance program, like Bring It Home, or are we talking across all of our rental housing programs?
Across all of them, please. Thank you.
We would need to follow up with you, Chair. We have that information, we just don't have it at our fingertips. And we'd have to figure out whether we're including the programs that you intend us to include in that count, since we have 30-some programs in legislatively named grantees right now. And some of them have 7 grantees a year, and some of them have lots of grantees per year, so there's some layers in unpacking that.
Any follow-up, Vice Chair Dotseth?
Follow-up would be, thank you, Chair Igoe. Question would be, as you mentioned, there are a number of new programs that were created, 23, 24. How many new programs would you say were actually created in that time frame? And the follow-up question with that would be is, what are we doing to make sure that we don't have overlap with these amount of different programs?
Commissioner Ho.
Chair and Representative Dotseth, so we are implementing those programs as you legislated and authorized them. I think that the question was not asked at the time of the final appropriations in 2023 whether there was some overlap between them. And I've had an opportunity to talk to the co-chairs, and there are places where we could have perhaps consolidated funding that was pulled out in a unique line item. But there were champions for a specific use within a broader program, and so that specific use got called out in 2023. I think a good example of that is high-rise sprinkler systems. There had been a tragedy in Minneapolis public housing high-rise. There had been death. There hadn't been sprinklers. And so this question of are these high-rises adequately serviced with sprinklers was kind of top of mind. And even though that would be an eligible use under a multifamily rehabilitation loan or a public housing geobond project, I think there was a desire by this body in 2023 to call that out as a specific use in a specific program.
Vice Chair Dotson.
So what would you say would be the estimated amount of new programs that were created approximately?
Commissioner Hall.
Chair and Representative, I believe that it was 16 programs and 15 legislatively named grantees. Some of the legislatively named grantees were for things that we had never done before, and some of them were carve-outs from the programs. Some of them were carve-outs from existing programs. Most of the carve-outs were from existing programs. We might have had a, I can't remember if we had a legislatively named grantee within a new program. I don't.
No.
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 MMCDC was a legislatively named grantee to a new program.
Vice Chair Dotseth.
Co-Chair Igo and Representative Dotseth. The one thing that I would kind of bring up specifically as you talk about different programs. I mean, there are programs for family homelessness prevention, which is targeted towards kind of short-term emergency rental assistance versus bring it home rental assistance, which is kind of ongoing subsidy. So there are some programs that have kind of similar titles and similar uses, but different populations that they're targeted and different length of time that individuals are on certain programs as well.
Vice Chair Dotseth.
Just a follow-up question. Thank you for your response to that. What would you say your operational agency's operational budget annually would be right now, and how many employees do you have employed at this point?
Do you need your laptop?
Yeah, probably.
Can I just going to switch these guys for a second? we brought all this. We just we didn't bring Ryan on time, so we're just give us a moment to get caught up. We do submit an annual report to the legislature, and you got one on February 15th that does have agency operating budgets year to year, including FTE counts. So we can resubmit that for you too.
And Ryan, you're pulling that up right now?
Yeah, and Co-Chair Igo and Representative Dotseth, we're about 350 full-time equivalents in terms of staffing levels.
And Deputy Commissioner, I'm being informed by staff. I need you to introduce yourself for the record.
Ah, great. I should do that, huh? Co-Chair Igo, members of the committee, my name is Ryan Baumtrug, Deputy Commissioner at Minnesota Housing.
Thank you. Yeah, Vice Chair Dotseth.
That's it for now. Thank you.
Next on my list will be Representative Scraba.
Thank you, Chair. So I'm trying to wrap my head a little bit around this. Allocate the funds. As long as they're sitting in our bank, the interest is used by the state of Minnesota for here. But once we transfer those dollars to you, it's an electronic transfer. A nod of the head is fine because I want to keep going without having to go back through it. So the electronic transfer is the way it's done. So these dollars are sitting in your fund now. And sometimes they might get used right away. Sometimes it might be a year. Sometimes it might be a year and a half. Are those funds invested, or are they collecting simple compound interest? I'm not trying to confuse people, but you have them in a real bank, I believe, a bank where there is interest being paid on it by someone else. And then I'll stop there, but because I have more questions after that. But so what happens to the funds before they're dispersed? How much interest? What the percentage of the interest on those dollars? I'm just curious.
Commissioner Igo and Representative Scraba, imagine my surprise on July 3rd, 2023. There was a very large deposit put into our account. We manage large sums of money, and we have lots of structures for ensuring the prudent management of those funds. Because of the interest rate environment, and because we knew they would not all go out the door, that we had to follow the processes I previously outlined, we took advantage of the interest rate environment and created laddered certificates of deposit, so that we would always have access to funds as needed, but we were able to account for those funds so that they would always be segregated as the investment of state appropriated dollars. So they weren't like just put into the bank, where the totality of what I do is operating in the markets, right. But it was really in appreciation of the extraordinary size of the appropriation and the interest rate environment opportunity and the unknowns at that moment in time associated with what was it going to take to implement what you asked us to do, we were able to be, we were able to take advantage of the way that our state statute sets things up so that we can have those funds, we can earn interest on them, and reinvest them into the administration of the program or back into the program again, and that is what we've been doing.
Representative Scrava.
Thank you, Chair. So, and I'm pulling fictitious dollars out. So there's a $50 million deposit into your account. 6%, is that too high?
Commissioner Hall.
Chair, Representative Scrava, that's a little too high.
Okay.
We weren't in the market.
Right.
I mean, we were in safe certificates of deposit.
And are there...
Representative Scrava.
Sorry, Chair. Sure. Are there statutes regulating what you do, how you do that, from the legislature that gave you the authority to do that?
Representative Scrava, I believe it's statute 462A.20. Is that correct, Commissioner Hill?
Chair, it is, sir.
I did my homework.
Very good.
Representative Scrava.
Thank you. I'll just ask you next. And somewhere in here, we got to say thank you, Representative Howard, for that 23rd of July all of a sudden. Where did this come from? Representative Howard's going like, I'll tell you where that came from.
Hey.
So when you were talking about being a bank, one of the things that my first thoughts were, well, I know banks are regulated. So banks are regulated by the Minnesota Department of Commerce, the Minnesota State Charter, federal would be Federal Reserve. Are you guys regulated by anybody, or is this just an agency? What is your regulatory?
I'm going to start, Chair Igo and Representative Scrava, and then I'm going to let the Deputy Commissioner come and back clean up on that. I mean, we exist because of federal law that allowed states to create housing finance agencies. And for the purposes of issuing bonds in order to improve the rental housing market and the single family market. And so the work that we do is regulated by the bond market. It's overseen by the rating agencies. We have an independent annual audit. And there's just a whole bunch of banking industry regulations that apply to what we do there. The state has a statute, as the chair referenced, so that back in 1972, when the Fed said states may create housing finance agencies for this purpose, the legislature at that time created statute that allowed us to have a state agency that would take advantage mm-hmm. of these kind of treasury facilities that had been allowed by the Congress. And so I guess we're not regulated the same way that a community bank is regulated because we are a hybrid part of state government with oversight from the feds. But in many ways, you know, we have an independent auditor, we have an independent board of directors, we are overseen by you as a state-created entity, and our activity in the market, you know, is also authorized by the Congress. And then every now and then, Standard & Poor's and Moody's comes along, and they also take a look at the operations of the bank, because as an issuer of bonds, our being able to convince them that we have solid operations allows us to enjoy the high ratings that we've enjoyed from the independent raters, which are the same rating agencies that regulate the issuances of bonds by MMB or local municipalities.
Adequate? Representative Scrava.
Thank you, Chair. That's enough for now. Thank you. Thank you.
Representative Nash.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, I'm looking at a House fiscal analysis document that is available to our members. You have in your 24 through 26 appropriations fund approximately $1.6 billion, correct?
Commissioner Hill.
Chair, Representative, I am now looking at the same report as you, yes.
Yeah. And Mr. Chair.
Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. You talked about going through the chair, so I'm all about process. So RFPs that you have hanging out there are roughly $1 billion. Would that be a fair number to say based on this document?
Commissioner Hull.
Chair Igo, Representative Nash, not quite. Because as we went over in the process between cash in the account and selections and obligations and draws are different things. So we can select a grantee. We don't write them the check that day. We execute a contract. We go through a whole process. We don't prepay the full amount of the grant. And for our production programs, which is the third largest thing that we do and the largest thing that we do with your funds, we're talking about the timeline of development. So I can select, let's say, a $10 million multifamily development to an organization that still needs to find another $1.5 million to have complete financing to close. It can take them anywhere from 6 months to 2 years to organize the rest of their financing to close. Then we do closing documents, and then they get ready to put a shovel in the ground, and then they begin to do construction draws. And so we could be sitting on funds that have been committed but not drawn for 1, 1.5, 2, sometimes 3 years, depending on the complexity of getting the totality of the financing for that new construction project. And then the length of the build also then, because we don't, we check to make sure that the building is going well and that we're on budget and we're going to get that thing built. So the life cycle of making selections is kind of governed by the competitive RFP process, but the life cycle of funds out the door could live through a longer period of the loaner grant. And that's why you see more cash than the cash line doesn't demonstrate all of the RFP activity, program development, selections, and contracting that we have done since the money was appropriated.
Representative Nash.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Well, Commissioner, first, I wanted to correct something. You talked about how you have X number of dollars of your funds. It's not the legislator's funds. It's the taxpayer's funds. And it just boggles my mind. And this is a document you have right in front of you. $1.6 billion in total of 24 through 26 appropriations. Total RFP funds announced from 23 through 26, right? $1.09 billion, right? You're leaving $500 million behind, correct? Give or take, since you're using rough approximation numbers. You're earning
sure. I'm actually not quite done, Madam Chair. Some of those RFPs that are in process right now. I think none of it's left behind.
Commissioner, if we could have Representative Nash finish this question. Thank you. Representative Nash.
Because we are about process. This is taxpayer money that you're earning interest on. You've already admitted to that. We've tried to get the exact amount of dollars. What is the exact amount of interest earned over this fund that has sat idle in the last 2 years? Give me that number, if you would.
Commissioner Hull.
Chair Igo and Representative Nash, if the question is how much interest has the agency earned over that period of time, I'll turn it over to my
Co-Chair Igo, Representative Nash, in fiscal year 24 and 25, the agency earned $99.6 million in interest earnings for those two fiscal years.
Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. $99.6 million of interest.
Okay.
I've been on this housing committee, I think it's been Co-Chair Howard and myself. We're the long-term members. I remember again and again and again and again and again how you have come before us and you have asked, oh, we need more money. We don't have enough money. We're out of money. This is oversubscribed. We need more money. Help us, please. We need more money. And yet you've got the temerity to sit here and tell me that you've got $99.6 million in interest. And the rollout of these things, I get construction takes time. I do. But you come back to the well again and again and again after historic funding from the previous biennia, and you come before us this year, oh, we need more funding. We're fresh out of money. I doubt the average taxpayer in the state of Minnesota understands that you have earned in interest alone, your words, $99.6 million. When they have heard, taxpayers have heard a constant refrain of, well, we're just going to ask for a little bit more money from you because we got to help people. And your interest earnings alone are $99.6 million, and yet you keep coming back for more. It's both shocking and I find it offensive. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Next on my list is Representative Meckland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, to follow up on what Representative Nash was just talking about, how much of that $99.6 million is currently unspent?
Commissioner Hill.
Chair and Representative Meckland, so one thing just to frame it is that the interest earnings on the large appropriation in 2023 will decline over the seven-year or so life cycle of the agencies being responsible for the administration of the 30 new programs that we had to stand up as a result of the package. So we have to anticipate that the interest earnings decline over time as expenditures increase, but the obligation to be able to close out these programs and make sure that they operate with integrity throughout their life cycle is really critical. So, for example, we have added staff to get these programs stood up, but we still have not hit the total amount of staffing that we'll need to do the compliance and closeout functions of these over time. And so we're trying to project what is the total cost of administering the new programs in an unpredictable interest rate environment, and what will be the pace of the drawdown of the funds across 30 different programs with a myriad of grantees. And that's something of a scale that the agency really didn't have historic data to be able to forecast. So, yes, sir, we have begun to draw down those funds for the covering of the administrative costs associated with these new programs. But the period over time which we're going to have that operational capacity extends quite a ways into the future because of where we are in the life cycle of those 30 different programs.
Representative Meckland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So what is the number that's unspent currently?
Debbie.
Co-Chair Igo, Representative Meckland. In fiscal years 24 and 25, we spent nearly $33 million on the administrative costs of just the state-appropriated programs at Minnesota Housing. So for the 2 years where we had interest earnings, it was about $99 million, and we've spent $33. What I would say is, we spent more in fiscal year 25 than we did in 24. We anticipate spending more in 26 than we did in 25. So as the commissioner alluded to, our costs are going up, and we believe interest earnings, so what we've earned so far, is going to go down in subsequent years. We think we've hit the high water mark on interest earnings. So interest earnings going down, costs will be continuing to go up.
Representative Meckland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. All right, I think we've learned that you're basically sitting on $66 million. And I get the fact that it's unpredictable going forward, but that yet you will be coming here next year asking for more money. So you talked about you have nonprofits administers a lot of this for rental administration and other parts of these dollars. Is that correct?
Chair and Representative, yes, that's correct. And local units of government.
Representative Meckland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, how much are they? Do you have a set number of what they're allowed to keep in administrative fees for whatever dollars you send to them?
Commissioner.
Chair and Representative, that varies by program and is usually outlined in program guides, if not in statute. Sometimes it's in statute, sometimes it's not. Sometimes it's in program guides, and then it's codified in a contract.
Representative Meckland.
My final thought on this, Mr. Chair, if you could put together that number of like 23, 24, what the total, what was allocated to all these different entities, and then how much they were allowed to keep on administrative fees. And I think it would be a pretty easy number, but I think it would be interesting to see what we're letting all these, how much of this money is being used by them, when it's, so it's not technically getting to the people. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Representative Myers, I think, did you have a question? Representative Scraba has a follow-up then.
Thank you. I think it's, quote, exciting that there's $100 million in interest. How much goes into the housing, actual housing units? How many more housing units are being developed with that those dollars? And how much staff do you have to, when you said our load tripled, how much staff do you hire to do that, the workload?
Commissioner.
Chair Igo and Representative Straub, let me start, and then I'm going to pass it over to Ryan. First of all, the interest earnings from state appropriations, if not needed for agency admin, will be put back into programs. So it doesn't go someplace else. It's just that it was very hard, given the breadth of programs that were created in 2023, to accurately predict in July of 2023 what it was going to cost to stand these up and operate them. We have added substantial new staff since we got the result in 2023, and we are continuing to add staff. We are focused more at the beginning around organizational capacity and building the front end of those programs. Now we're dealing with a more complex grants administration and program integrity kind of statutorily environment. So we've got more work that my staff needs to do throughout the operation in the closeout of these programs. So that's why I say that the administration of these programs will easily have some of them a 7-year life cycle from translating your statutory intent, getting the money out, the life of the grant, and the closeout.
So, Commissioner, if I could just interject there, I'm going to take a little privileges chair on this one.
Yes.
When you talk about the agency being able to fund those programs with the interest, is it the program where the dollars are statutorily applied to, or is it any program that falls inside Minnesota Housing Finance's purview?
Chair Igo, it is state appropriated programs, and there is very specific language, and I would want to follow up with you with the very specific language, but we don't take interest earnings from state appropriated programs and reinvest them in other banking activities that the agency does. State appropriated stays state appropriated, including interest and use of interest.
So then just follow up to that question. So no interest earned on state funded appropriations has ever gone into the pool two or pool three for your mortgage and lending based parts of Minnesota Housing Finance?
Chair Igo, that is correct.
Thank you. Representative Scraba.
Okay, now that you took my question. I'm kidding.
Sorry.
No, you're good. That's kind of where I was going. And the only other question that I have, because I was going to ask, is there any legislative oversight on the administrative costs and for that? Is there any?
Commissioner.
Chair Igo, Representative Scraba, I mean, you always have the opportunity for oversight of programs that you appropriate and create.
Okay. Then one more, then I'm done. Do you allow debit stacking for developers, like grants, getting grants stacked up and ready to go, or do they have to disperse them before they keep going?
Commissioner.
Chair Igo and Representative Scraba, I'm going to give you the unsatisfactory it depends, because the work we do in single family, you oftentimes have a developer who wants to do 40 homes, and they might get a grant to do like the first 4. And then the next year they come in and they get a grant to do another 4. And if there's a balance of funds left from the first grant, can we do a contract adjustment from the first grant so that it helps offset the costs on the second build and the second construction?
Mm-hmm.
But there's a lot of oversight around how that money is stacked. On the multifamily side, it can be really complex deals that have 10 or 11 capital sources in them, but there's a lot of oversight on that. including sometimes from the tax credit investors in those projects who have their own interests in making sure that the structure of those multifamily deals is sound.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Scrava.
So you do allow it?
Chair, Representative, I think I would need more precision on the question to be able to answer the question precisely, but we'd be happy to follow up with you.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Representative Norris.
Thank you, Chair Igo and Commissioner. Appreciate your testimony. In one of the slides, it was slide 21, you mentioned $51.2 million from 2014 to 2023 as kind of an amount in terms of administrative costs that had to be subsidized. But I'm wondering if you could just kind of give us a ballpark number of what's the agency's operating costs in a given year.
Commissioner.
Chair Igo and Representative Norris, I'd like to toss that over to my deputy.
Co-Chair Igo, Representative Norris. So our actual spend in fiscal year 25 across the entire agency was $54.8 million. And our planned spending for the current fiscal year 26, is $59.2 million across all of the agency's functions.
Representative Norris.
Nothing further, Chair. Thank you.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Chair Igo. Thank you, Commissioner, for coming forward. I'm trying to get my head around what is going on here. And so I'm trying to, you said, if I understand correctly, you said there'd be about a 7-year time frame for you to complete the tasks that you were given by this committee and the legislators, correct?
Commissioner.
Chair Representative, correct.
Okay. And Mr.
Chair. Representative Johnson.
So how big do you think this is going to be by the time you, and how many hires will there need to be before that 7-year time frame has been achieved?
Commissioner.
Chair and Representative Johnson, we have tried to approach that question kind of conservatively and as we go. So for example, one of the decisions we needed to make when we started is should these be permanent hires or temporary? Given our experience during the administration of federal pandemic aid, we had had some temporary hires, and we realized that a temporary hire is always looking for their next job. And so we made the decision to have them be permanent agency hires, and because we have a reasonable amount of attrition, natural attrition out of the agency due to other jobs or retirement or other things, we just assumed that over that cycle, we would know when we were still expanding and when we would need to once again contract. We are still at the expansion end of that, growing the administration, the agency's capacity to be able to handle all these funds, but we all know as a leadership team, that there's a point in time at which functions that were needed when we stood up the program are no longer needed, functions that were needed to monitor active grants are no longer needed, and closeout's the last thing. Each of these new programs or legislatively named grantees is on a slightly different start date, end date, because we couldn't stand up 30 things all at the same time. And so some of them will open, we had programs that opened and closed in one calendar year. And then we have other programs that will take the full 5-year allowed life cycle of a state grant. So that's where we're understanding the questions that we need to be asking in order to do prudent management and the decision points that will come in the future. But we are not in a position yet to have enough data to be able to forecast, when exactly will this all have been completed.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for that. I'm trying, so in my time that I've been down here, I've been hearing mostly what I hear is, and this seems to be unique here, and maybe you can help me with my understanding, is that so many departments and so many programs is we have a need, please fund us to help us with that need. From here, from what I'm still trying to grasp is it seems like here's a huge amount of money, go find a need. because, and that need has taken 7 years to complete to find that need. That's why I just think it's kind of unusual, because the reason I say that is because here's all this money. You can't spend it, so go throw it in a bank and earn interest on it and fund your administrative costs. That's why I just kind of am having trouble with this, because it just seems backwards to me, where it's just, here's the money, go find a way to spend it, as opposed to, we already found a need and the way to spend it. Now, please fund us. So, thank you, Chair.
Chair, may I?
Yep, Commissioner.
And Representative Johnson, thank you for the question. If you go back to the beginning of the 2023 legislative session and you take a look at what the governor, lieutenant governor proposed, they proposed expanding existing programs where we knew there was a lot of need. And if we had put all of the funding from the 2023 session into existing programs, the pace of being able to get the funding out onto the street would have been faster. At that point in time, the legislature decided that instead of doing that, they chose to create new programs and a lot of legislatively named grantees for specific activities. So the administrative lift for the agency and the speed of cash out the door would have been faster and simpler if we had put the money into existing programs. The legislature made a different choice, and so we have had to figure out how to implement the choices that were made, and it's much more complex than if the money had gone into existing programs. And so that's the difference between, I think, what we had imagined and what we're living.
Okay, thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. First, I just want to make a few comments based on the discussion, and then I do have a few questions myself. First, since we're kind of talking about 2023 and on, and I want to be clear that impacts are making a huge difference in people's lives with those investments, and want to thank the Commissioner of Minnesota Housing for implementing existing programs and new programs. Things like down payment assistance is mostly out the door to folks, in life-changing resources to help first-time home buyers for thousands of folks. Our bring-it-home rental assistance dollars are starting to hit families in ways that will be life-changing. And so just naming that those pieces are hitting folks. And just, again, in the housing realm, it isn't as simple as just passing $1 billion that's going to go out via some formula like a property tax refund. You know, the pace of development of housing does take a longer arc, but with a huge payoff in direct, actually, where we need to go to build more homes. So that's one point. And would we wish that some of those programs would be implemented sooner? Of course. But as the commissioner said, it is true that we did identify needs and decide not to do things the way we've always done them, which I think was apropos. Two, we do want to have stewardship of those resources, like the presentation before indicated. You know, as we've talked about in this committee, you know, we haven't had a lot of discussion about fraud in the Minnesota housing realm, and that takes staff, compliance, the things that were mentioned. And the reality is that Minnesota housing is a different animal. You know, we could decide, like other state agencies, to fund their staff through a direct appropriation. That's a different policy choice. We haven't had to do that before. So I'm just naming that, you know, we could, all of the investment resource that what we've been talking about here, if that all went right back into programs, you know, we'd probably have to, as a legislature, figure out how we're going to fund the staffing of those programs and do so differently. And maybe that's a choice we should consider, but I'm just naming that it isn't as if this resource, this investment resource, in itself, that process is a bad one. In fact, it's a good one. We should want to have a larger investment of the public resource and stewardship, and make sure that resource is going back in ways that meet the public good. either through staffing and administering programs or in putting the resource back into the programs that'll hit people and improve people's lives. And so those are just some of my general thoughts. I do think, I do have some questions similar to actually one of Representative Johnson's questions. You know, this notion that the interest earnings, if they're greater than the actual expenses, will go back to the programs. That makes sense to me. But if the sort of timeline piece of it is we have to wait several years to make that estimate, and if we're being conservative, there is a risk, isn't there, that we've sort of left a big chunk of resource sitting there that could have be deployed elsewhere or more quickly back into programs? I guess that's a question.
Commissioner.
Chair Igo, Chair Howard. That's a question that my finance team, my programs teams, our outside financial advisors are asking ourselves all the time. And we have already thought about what is the best way to do this. For example, nobody thought this interest rate environment would persist as long as it did, right? In the summer of 2023, I think conventional wisdom was that interest rates would go back down in the near future. They have not. We did not anticipate like the current economic situation and what impact that might have on when interest rates will go down. We also did not know exactly what it was going to take to hold these programs up, how long it was going to take to run them, and how fast cash was going to go out. So I guess what I would say is that the most important thing is that all of us be monitoring this over time. But I think it's a Goldilocks problem, right? I mean, you want to get it just right. You want to make sure that if the interest earnings exceed what we're going to need for the administrative costs of that program, that we can get it back into the program as quickly as possible. But we don't want to have reinvested or moved those interest earnings before we have an understanding of what the life cycle of the program is going to cost, or we're going to have a problem with closeout, program integrity, or we're going to be coming back to a legislature that has no pride of authorship in the 2023 bill and say you have to finish paying for what they started, you know, 7 years ago. And so I think the path that we're trying to carve is to be good fiscal stewards of these dollars, to do the best that we can do in their administration to meet the intent of the legislature in creating them, while building in good program integrity, support the capacity of the field to be able to do the work well, and track the money well so that we can promise you that interest earned on funds that were appropriated in 2023 will go towards those intents if they're not needed for program administration.
In co-chair. That's helpful. So is it, if what I'm hearing is at this stage, you would say that you don't have enough information, that you need this level of investment earned potentially to fund, and so maybe next year you reevaluate and see if at that stage we might make a different choice and put some of that money back or keep as it is. And so when you say like at how many intervals will you as an agency kind of take a look at this? And I guess what I'm trying to get at is, I guess how likely or how not likely some of those interest investments might end up going back into programs, because it is a significant amount of money and there are significant needs. I don't think anybody here likes the idea of large sums of money just sitting somewhere if it could be deployed to meet needs that are clear and present.
Commissioner.
Chair Igo, Chair Howard, I mean, that's a question that we're asking. I mean, certainly on a monthly review of financial statements, certainly on a quarter review of financial statements, you know, every time I never thought I'd set my clock to the Federal Reserve setting interest rates, but in this job, like, I set my clock to the Federal Reserve setting interest rates. Are they going up? Are they going down? Are they staying the same? We're looking at cash outlays. You know, what is our expectation around when the cash on hand, you know, begins to decline, you know, more dramatically because we have more contracts in place and more construction projects that are underway, that the whole Bring It Home Rental Assistance Voucher Program is up and utilized. So there's a lot of moving parts in that question, but we have a sophisticated financial management and oversight structure that's integrated with our program staff to be able to ask those questions at the front end and every step along the way, and to be able to report back here with the transparency that you deserve around how are those funds earning interest, why are they earning interest, will those interest earnings, you know, what will they be used for, and at what point in time will they go back? It's just that I can't see all the way around the corner for how much of the life of these programs is left.
Coach Howard.
I guess just my, I really appreciate that. And my, I guess, last comment is I think conversations like this are really valuable. And I think figuring out ways to have a little more line of sight from the legislative perspective on this is helpful to try to assess choices and dynamics so that we can kind of meet what I think should be shared goals, that the agency has appropriate staffing to administer programs well, that we are getting dollars to meet the needs of the people, and that the programs have integrity, you know, and at the same time, make sure that with the huge needs we have in housing, that we're pulling every lever we can in the here and now at the same time. And so information like this is valuable, and we just encourage more of it. I think the more transparency we have, the better we are to sort of work together and kind of sort through what's the right balance to strike, you know, between the addressing current needs and making sure that the agency has what it needs to administer these programs in the long term.
Well, seeing no further discussion, I'm going to try and wrap everything in a bow. I've been listening a lot. I only jumped in once. Here's, I guess, my first question before I bring us to the spreadsheet. Through your statute as Minnesota Housing Finance Agency, you're allowed to take admin fees for what the state gives you, which is fine. It makes sense. But at the same time, if you're earning interest to help pay for expense, isn't that double dipping?
Chair Igo, thank you for the question and the opportunity to explain that. First of all, there is no double dipping. And so the question is, how do we pay for our admin expenses? Do we pay for the admin expenses by taking the money out of the authorized amount of the program, or do we pay for them relying heavily on the interest earnings? Historically, the interest earnings were small, so it really wasn't a question of this magnitude. And so we're operating in an interest earnings environment that is not like anything the agency has ever had to navigate before. So we're deeply understanding our statutory authority. You know, we're understanding legislative intent. So for example, when the 2023 legislature adjourned, there was a provision that allowed us to hold back part of a program's funds to pay for admin. There are places where the interest earned on those funds could cover admin. So there are places where contracts are being amended, for example, to some of the legislatively grantees, for us to put what we had withheld for administrative expenses back into the grant and rely on the interest earnings to cover the costs of that. So that if you were a legislatively named grantee and you thought you were getting, you know, $2 million and your contract was for $1,900,000 and something, we can amend when we realize that we don't have to do that to cover the admin costs. But again, this has been a learning environment for us because of the prolonged interest rate environment that we're in compared to what was forecast at the time that the appropriation was made.
Thank you for that. And kind of going on to that then, you know, one of the reasons there is so much interest is because it took so much time, right? And I'm not slating that on the agency. But when I look at the spreadsheet, and we'll go to that next. So now if we look at lines 23 and 24 of that analysis by House Fiscal, it talks about the bringing home rental assistance for the statewide and the metro sales tax. So this is where I start scratching my head and asking questions. Because if we look at bringing home rental assistance for the metro on line 24, we look at, you know, The total RFP that was announced, updated as of 3/26/26, is very, very close to what the appropriations were leading up to that. You know, so admin costs, you know, pretty close, apples to apples. But then if I go up a line and I see the statewide bringing home rental assistance, I see that that number is give or take half of what has been appropriated since that time. And there's $31 million sitting aside with no identifiable RFP. So then I start getting worried going, okay, for one, we're doing all of it. One of them, we're not. And now there's $31 million sitting in your account. Well, not really $31 million. It's more like $67 million because the RFP is going to be out there. It's going to be taking time. It's going to be earning more money. And the concern I have is that are we not doing the full amount because we're taking care of payroll and interest earnings there by looking at that account and saying, well, that one can wait, but this one can go.
Chair, I'm going to ask my deputy commissioner to answer this one. It's a fairly complex answer.
Go, Chair Argo. Specifically for bringing home, and one of the things that the spreadsheet identifies is three fiscal years.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that kind of different programs have different RFP cycles. And so for bringing home specifically, brand new program, we've done one RFP so far in 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
And the program will require another RFP, or we can use the statutory authority to use a formula to award that. So this is a part of new program getting created in 2024. The program is funded by general fund appropriations, and then as the spreadsheet shows, also by sales tax revenues, which had to be collected before we had enough to award. So in this case of bring it home, I think there's a couple factors going on, but one of them is just the timing of we're looking at 3 years of appropriations, and we haven't yet done the second round of funding for bring it home yet. The current contracts that are being executed right now run through some date, I forget the month, in 2027. And so we will be doing another process to award what we have, and the sales tax, more sales tax revenues that's come in since then, and the additional round of appropriations in that next round of funding. And so that's one thing I notice is going through the House Fiscal's presentation is RFP timelines are not the same across all programs. And so as we pick up 3 years of appropriations, it might just be we haven't gotten to that next RFP yet. And so that's part of the factor with bring it home.
So, and I understand like the RFP cycle and how that works, but it still doesn't really answer my question, because if there only has been one, why was one almost 100% and one was 50%? Because this line, column C, says total RFP funds announced through fiscal years 23 through today. One of them is at half, which is statewide, and the other one is almost at 100%. So why is there a discrepancy? Because you can see where then it leads my mind to believe, okay, well, it looks like there's $31 million sitting in reserve to earn interest on to help fund agency initiatives. And when we're talking about rental assistance, we've talked about that committee a lot and how that's a big thing. We need to get the money out the door. So that's what I'm trying to get to the root of right here.
Right, Co-Chair Argo, I mean, I think part of that factor is the applications of the metro. Sales tax needs to be used for applications in the metro, whereas the general fund appropriation can fund statewide. And so we use the metro sales tax to fund all of the applications and demand in the metro. And use the general fund appropriation to reach the balance of the state, where I don't know that we got complete sufficient applications to utilize more than what we awarded.
Again, I'm just still confused. If you had all, why wouldn't you have your RFP then match? And if it did fall short, then it is within your statute to come to legislature report and say, let's move that money to where it's needed. That's where the disconnect is happening with me right now on those funds.
Chair Argo, if I may, I think there's no doubt that there are families across the state of Minnesota who meet the definition of targeted priority for rental assistance, that the need is out there and it's real. So I think the question is we're building something that's basically built on a HUD distribution model. And so we had to work with partners that are used to working with HUD Section 8 vouchers to work through the process of how they would now take these state resources. And then we also had the opportunity to learn from their experience in administering HUD vouchers. So the appropriated dollars that we have for this program, we should not count on the fact that those will grow over time. And yet we know that there's some huge variables in terms of the cost of the rental assistance program to the administrators. including family size, bedroom size, rent increases over time. And when we took a look at that experience for the same people who do HUD rental assistance, it is has huge variability. The other variability component in this is the predictability of the sales tax revenue. So if we're going to have our partners issue 4,000, 4,500 vouchers to families, our partners and we want to make sure that we can follow through on the commitment to those families. We don't want to expend every dollar at the front end and then not have an inflation adjuster for rent increases, or not know if a voucher for a one-bedroom was turned back, but a family of four got that same voucher for the next unit, and the rent was $1,000 higher a month, that there wouldn't be money in order to pay for that. So between rent inflation, variable family size, and unpredictable sales tax revenue, and no reason to expect that the appropriated dollars would grow with need, our partners have also wanted to approach the rollout of this program with some caution so that they didn't overpromise and then underdeliver. So, I mean, I do expect that we will get to a place where we're better able to predict and the flow of funds will be more real time, but it just wasn't going to be in the first cycle. And that's having been in dialogue with the folks who have been administering these for HUD for decades.
And again, and thank you for that. Again, maybe this is just where we disagree, because everything you just said, it sounds like we're fine with 100% doing everything you just said for the metro sales tax region, but not for statewide. And that just doesn't, it's not connecting for me there. Because if we had that much confidence for the metro area, why didn't we have the confidence to do the full RFP for statewide? But I want to go to one other thing, and then we can kind of, I think there's one more question I want to get to. But if we go to line 44, this is another point that I wanted to kind of highlight and just get some clarity on. So community stabilization for the recap of distressed buildings, which we know is a big issue. We've heard about in this committee. It's something we want to address. The application closed mid-November of last year. When would those funds be announced that they have been awarded and potentially handed out?
Chair Igo, just a clarification on the previous question before I answer this, if I may.
Yeah, absolutely.
We didn't get applications from Greater Minnesota administrators to cover the whole geography of the state. And so that is something that we are grappling with, because we do believe that it should be a statewide program, and how do we build administrator capacity to be able to do that? So that's something that we need to understand about why is it that some places who were eligible to apply did not. And so we're working with those stakeholders to understand that. Because I don't think it would have been satisfying either to have released all the money and then come back with a map that shows big holes in certain parts of the state. So I just wanted to put that in there. On the distressed properties building, the spreadsheet I have for some reason is just one line item off, but community stabilization recapitalize of distressed buildings. We're in the final decision-making process around the awarding of those funds, and they'll be going to board
May or June.
In May or June.
Okay. Thank you. So, and the reason I ask is this just, again, gets at why, like, the interest thing, right? So it closed in November, and now let's say June. You know, that's 8 months, again, that the agency had close to $50 million that's sitting on the side, you know, accruing interest, that you as the agency then get to decide what program it goes into. And again, I'm not going to say we don't need to have fraud preventions, and this is tough work, and there's lots of I's that need to be dotted and T's that need to be crossed. But both sides of the aisle agree here that things need to be done in housing, and the taxpayers of Minnesota are giving money through this committee to get things done. So I just, it's hard to see that sometimes. People hate when government moves slow and doesn't help them when they need it. So I had to outline, and then I want to follow up with my last point, and then I'll go to Representative Johnson because I know he has one more. So at your board meetings, are those open to the public and virtual, like I could log into my computer to watch them, or are they more like in-person closed meetings?
Chair Igo, ever since we made adjustments around COVID, we went completely to telephone for a while. That was fun. And then we went to video, and then we went to video hybrid. So, and I think we actually have seen more legislative staffers monitor those board meetings.
in terms of the questions that we'll get after board meetings. So yes, they are open to the public and they're announced. All the materials published a week before the meetings, and they're the fourth Thursday of every month from 1 to 3 o'clock.
And then are those meetings recorded?
Yes.
Can you go watch one?
I don't think we post them on the website, but we can make it available.
Chair Igo, they are recorded. There are minutes approved, and we could make the transcripts or the recording available. I've never had that request, so I don't know exactly what the technology would be, but yes.
No, the reason I bring it up is, again, we're talking about some long time as you're dealing with unique amounts of money. You know, I know that my little town board can't meet without a Zoom link and recording and having it on their website. So I just want to make sure that that's applying to, you know, one of our state agencies that's dealing with a lot of money. So, but that concludes my questions. Representative Johnson, we got just a few minutes. I want to give you time to ask your closing question.
Thank you, Chair Igo. Thank you. Just had a question real quick, thought about this after the fact. So we're talking about the 7-year time frame and your hiring and stuff like that. So are you hiring employees for specific projects, and then when that project's done, they're done as an employee, or are they just moving on to the next project? And I guess my question is are you just going to keep hiring, and all of a sudden one day you're going to have a mass layoff, or how does that work? Or do you try to use the same person over and over again?
Commissioner.
Chair Igo and Representative Johnson, thank you for that. I mean, one of the things that's been nice about expanding staff is that it's created promotion and cross-training opportunities for existing staff. So a lot of times when I post a new position, I end up hiring three times. Somebody inside moves into that position because it's interesting to them. Somebody else from inside the agency moves into that person's position, and then we're posting outside for a new person to come in at a more entry level. You think about it as kind of rows and columns. Like, we're organized around the divisions of our work, multifamily, single family, which includes manufactured housing and housing stability. And then we also have functions like operations and grants management, IT, legal, finance. And so I've had to build both in rows and columns. I think the expectation when you come to Minnesota Housing is, with a few rare exceptions, you're not just going to only do one thing, but we do have people who specialize in specific things. But I think what we're planning for, because I have attrition all the time, is that we're planning for the fact that when it's time to begin to reduce staffing, that we'll do that in pace with natural attrition wherever we can. The goal is not to hire up and then lay off, or I would not be able to get good people.
Okay. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Commissioner, your team, and to your agency. Again, this was very helpful to getting us to understand. Again, sounds like it's a unique opportunity, but it is also our duty as legislators to our constituents and the taxpayers of Minnesota that when we do start seeing that there's not just a couple million, like, which is historically accurate if you look back in the agency's history, but now with this kind of money, it was on our duties to make sure we talked about that and had a conversation on it. So I appreciate you giving us this deep dive and answering our questions and having this discourse with us today. So thank you. With that, members, we had one more item on the agenda. We were going to do an informational hearing, but seeing that we have 2 minutes and I've got Ways and Means and 15 would like to get a bite to eat before that, we are going to adjourn. So thank you, members.
Thank you.